Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is William Bell, and today we are grateful to have you with us for Blog Talk, our Blog Talk Radio 2 Men in the Bible broadcast. And just shortly, Don Preston will be joining us. He may be already on, and we could be having just a bit of technical difficulty with getting him on, but I'm looking forward to having him shortly. So just be patient. We should have him on the line in just a few minutes. We are going to sort of finish a little bit of the discussion that we started on last week, talking about the tabernacle and resurrection, but we're going to transition into a discussion on the resurrection of Christ. And so we will cover that in our discussion tonight. Let me just check with some in the chat room to see if you're able to hear me. And if you can, please respond, because we want to make sure that we are broadcasting live. So if you can hear the broadcast, please just respond. We appreciate you being in with us today. We started a discussion on the tabernacle and the resurrection, saying that the tabernacle is where death is removed. And, of course, we took that tip from Revelation chapter 21. And verse 4 particularly, but that particular context, because there it says, you know, there would be no more death. And that being the context and the focus for our study on last week. So today we're going to look at that. I believe we have Don here, so let's see if we can get him on. All right, Don, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. We're having just a little bit of difficulty. And we're going to go ahead and begin with our subject for today. Just a bit of difficulty with the line today. I'm hoping that you can hear me okay. And we sent a message in the chat room to see if you could hear, and we didn't get any response there. So I'm not sure if you're actually able to hear. And I wanted to confirm that before we went on. So if you are able to hear, please just, you know, raise your hand, say yes. Okay, very good. Thank you, Raph. We appreciate that very much. And so we're going to go on. Don Preston is back. I'm going to see if we can get him in on the line. Don, I know you're here. And you're
yes.
On.
I continue to have double feedback, William. Yes.
Okay, you can hear me okay?
Yes, I can now.
Okay, great, great. Everything should be working fine. All right, ladies and gentlemen, sorry about that, but I'm not sure what was going on. It sounded like we might have been connected on two lines where you're getting that feedback, but everything seems to be okay now. All right, well, let's go ahead. Are you still having some difficulty? All right, I'm not sure where that's coming from, but, you know, we'll get that worked out. Just if you can bear with it as much as possible. Let's see if we can get through the broadcast for today. Okay?
Okay.
All right. And I may have to do some translating for you, ladies and gentlemen. There may be a little bit of double talk, but we're gonna get through this, and we'll get it corrected. We're doing something a little bit different here, and so we just simply have to work out the little kinks, and then it should be okay. All right. So as I said, we were discussing the tabernacle of God, where death is removed. And we talked about that subject a little bit at length on last week. Some of the points that we made was that the tabernacle of God arrived in 70 AD, that is, in its consummation. And, of course, that was Revelation chapter 21, verse 1 and following. We pointed out that the heaven and earth which passed in that context was the same heaven and earth that's mentioned in Matthew 5, 17 and 18, refers to the Old Covenant Judaism, to the state of Israel as it was taught in the New Covenant, or rather in the Gospels, as well as in the Epistles. We also mentioned Matthew 24, 35. The events were all done within that generation. Both Matthew 5, 17 and 18 points that out, Luke 21, 20 through 22 and verse 32 that says all of those things happened in that generation. And we made it clear, at least in our understanding, that Revelation 21 and verse 22 show that this temple, this new temple, was Christ. In other words, the eschatological temple is both God and Christ. And so they being one, of course, that is the meaning of the eschatological temple. Well, that temple, the foundation of that temple, was expressed in the New Testament, and that was what we had been discussing on the previous week. Now, when we talk about the tabernacle, we also mentioned that the glory of God, from an eschatological point of view, and actually when we look in the all the way from Genesis through the tabernacle of Moses, as well as the temple of Solomon, etc., that the glory of God has always been a tabernacle concept. It's always been related to the tabernacle. And so when we look at passages, even what we consider to be passages related to the parousia, those passages are in a context of the tabernacle. And that was one of the points that we were establishing. We talked about the glory. We demonstrated from Revelation 21 that when John was called to see the bride, the Lamb's wife, the text said that she had the glory of God. So there again, you see the glory of God in connection with the tabernacle. We pointed out that the tabernacle was the focus of, or that the focus of the tabernacle was removal of sin, that it was not associated with removal of physical death. That was not the end goal of the work in the tabernacle, or God's relationship with Israel, with Adam, or even in the new tabernacle. It always has been a focus on sin. The animals and sacrifices, as in the types and shadows, were simply pointing to the ultimate sacrifice, which was Jesus himself. And so from day one, it's always been a focus on a relationship with God, and that which jeopardizes that relationship, of course, was sin. Then we talked about the presence of God. As far as God's presence, it was always a tabernacle presence. It was always associated with the tabernacle. And we looked at John 4, 21 through 24. Now, in our discussion on John 21, 24, one of the things that we were pointing out was that the temple that's mentioned in that context, when Jesus is talking about the two mountains, saying to the woman in Samaria that they would neither worship in Mount Gerizim nor in Jerusalem, but they would worship in spirit and in truth. One of the things that we point out there is that, you know, Jesus' discussion is about the places of worship. He's not talking about a geocentric location, but he's talking about a theocentric location, if you please. He says we must worship God in spirit and in truth. And in the Greek, those are locatives, and they denote location. So not in Mount Gerizim, not in the physical city of Jerusalem, but in God and Christ, you know, in the spirit. This corresponds to Revelation 21 and verse 22. But another point that we made in talking about John 4, 21 through 22, was that the time statements that are used there are the same time statements which are used in John 5. And so the concept of the tabernacle, especially as we are speaking about it is the place where death is removed, connects these two passages together. Now, we've had some who've been very, very resistant to that idea, to that concept. You know, they think John 5 is about resurrection, and resurrection is about the removal of physical death, and that John 4 is about worship, and that there is really no connection between the two. So there's been this attempt to make the time statements of John 5 refer to a spiritual resurrection in verse 25, and then as it progresses through the text to verses 28 and 29, to focus on a physical resurrection that is still future to us today, and therefore has not occurred. And of course, there are all kinds of problems with that interpretation, and one of the reasons we introduced John 4, 21 through 24 is because it's a parallel text that deals with resurrection. It's got the same time statements, And as we progress, we demonstrated from the eschatological consummation of that tabernacle that it was focused on the removal of death, and again, that is sin death and the consummation of that process. Now, we've had those in other camps, whether futurist or partial preterist, et cetera, who agree that Revelation 21 is fulfilled in 70 AD or has been fulfilled in 70 AD, and that it is not about the removal of physical death. However, we do have, you know, quite a bit of controversy on some of the other passages. It seems like we've lost Don for a minute. Don, you might try getting in the chat room to see if that will help, and if not, just go ahead and call back in, and we will, you know, we'll try to get you on. I noticed that you were there for a moment, but it, you know, it just appears that you've dropped off the line. Now, so as we were saying, we were talking about this resurrection and tabernacle typology. And in a moment, we're going to talk about the death of Christ to point out how it relates in this subject and in this theme as well. But let's consider the context of the tabernacle from 2 Corinthians 5. Now, in that chapter, we pointed out the fact that here is Paul talking about the tabernacle, which is a resurrection text. And when I looked at any of the scholars, looked at any of the commentaries, there's been no distinction between the text in 1 Corinthians 15, especially those that talk about putting on mortality and incorruption, et cetera, as compared to 2 Corinthians chapter 5.
All right.
So as I was saying, I was sort of make comparison from 2 Corinthians 5, pointing out that that's tabernacle typology. I actually had someone to write me in response to this lesson and ask about the tabernacle and the resurrection as it related to spiritual resurrection in addition to the covenant based on the text in 2 Corinthians 5. One of the things that I pointed out is that there was a depth correlation between 2 Corinthians 5 and 1 Corinthians. And, you know, the text in verse 54 that talks about putting on mortality and, or being clothed with mortality is the exact same text of 2 Corinthians 5, and that's in a context of the tabernacle. So these passages are all parallel. They all correlate together. And so there's no distinction between them. And, of course, you know, everyone that I know, Don, and you can comment on this if you like, but everyone that I know has always taken 2 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15, Revelation 21, and you can throw in 1 Thessalonians 4 as well, but have always taken those to be parallel texts and all relate to one and the same thing. Now, they may make them all future. They may make some of them future, some not. But the point being, I don't know any scholars who have looked at this over the years and not seen that correlation between all of those.
Well, I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, Greg Beale, in his really just mostly excellent book on the temple and the church's mission or mission of the church, goes through all of these texts and points out the temple imagery in each one of these texts and a host of others, by the way. And by the way, I would really recommend anyone to read that book. What they will find is that Greg Beale sees temple imagery in so many texts, and he does a fantastic job, by the way, of showing temple language in texts that perhaps people have never seen the temple language before. But he demonstrates in a very powerful linguistic way how so much language of both the Old Testament and the New is, in fact, temple language. And I'll guarantee you, William, the point that you made there is absolutely unequivocally and undeniably true. The scholars throughout the centuries have seen these texts as eschatological. They have likewise seen them in many, many, many cases as temple imagery, and likewise, speaking of resurrection. What's fascinating to me, William, is what you and I have noted on several different occasions. All of a sudden, now that the preterist movement is beginning to point out the very obvious temple imagery, the very obvious resurrection imagery in these texts, all of a sudden the folks in the futurist camp are coming up with all of these brand spanking new slants and takes on some of these texts in a desperate attempt to divorce temple imagery from resurrection. It's just astounding to me what we are beginning to see, well, what we've been seeing for a good little while, in the futurist camp. And by the way, what's interesting to me, William, is we have so many people now who are ostensibly, at least, in the postmillennial camp, and some who are former preterists, and they're wanting to deny the connection between temple and resurrection. And yet what's fascinating to me is that historically many very prominent postmillennialists have been some of the strongest advocates in their exegesis of seeing temple and resurrection as inseparably connected. Let me simply illustrate that by a modern example. Anyone familiar with the writings of James Jordan, with whom I had a debate in, I guess, not in 2004, everyone knows that James Jordan goes back and discusses the Garden of Eden and points out how the Garden of Eden was considered to be what? The most holy place. He discusses wonderfully, as a matter of fact, in several of his writings, of the temple imagery of the Garden of Eden. Well, let me see. So the Garden of Eden is considered and discussed in temple imagery motifs, temple imagery language, that is, linguistics. So what do we have in the temple? Presence of God. What do we have? Man and woman kicked out of the temple. Where do we wind up in Revelation 21? The consummated, quote, restored temple of God, where man is once again in the garden, the most holy place, in the presence of God. It is absolutely astounding that anyone who would even begin to attempt to call themselves Bible students, and I don't want to come across as overly harsh or critical here, but it's just astounding to me how desperate people can become when they're attempting to refute covenant eschatology. And this is a classic example of it, and that is to deny the connection between temple and resurrection. How much more of a connection could there be than the Garden of Eden as the most holy place, man kicked out of the garden, which is death? So here is death and temple, but guess what? The restoration of the garden is resurrection, but that's restoration to the temple. Resurrection and temple are absolutely 100% interconnected from the very beginning, from the first words, basically, of the story of the Bible.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why the connection in John 4 and John 5 is creating so much pain in those camps where they are suggesting that there is, you know, that these are not related. It's because it just destroys this concept of a futurist physical viewpoint of the resurrection. Don, another place, and I wanted to get into this. You know, we've lost a lot of time kind of getting together, but I'll make sure I download this and edit a lot of the first part out so people won't have to go through that scenario they went through trying to get on. But let's shift a little bit as we talk about the tabernacle, because the basis of this, in my judgment, starts with Christ from beginning to end. And, of course, I know the garden, of course, is there, and we don't want to minimize that in any way. But I want to also talk about Christ. Now, let me introduce this through Jesus' statement in John chapter 2. We'll come to that in a moment. But I want to talk about something, and I find this just the order of this information. I want you to be thinking about this as we go. So we're about to, you know, go down a road here. I'm not sure you know totally where I'm going, but I think you do. You wrote a track some years ago about Jesus being born again. Do you recall that?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Okay. Why don't you kind of lay that premise out for us just a little bit? And as you do, I want you, you know, I'll bring us back to a point that I think is going to just flow really well in our discussion of tabernacle and resurrection.
Okay. Much of the approach that I took in that article was pointing out that under the Levitical Judaic system, Christ could not serve as a priest. That he was of the tribe of Judah, and mm-hmm. as Hebrews chapter 7 says, Moses spake nothing concerning the tribe of Judah in regard to the priesthood. It was forbidden. Hebrews chapter 8 points out that Christ, if he were on earth, could not serve as a priest, seeing that there are priests who serve according to the law, Hebrews chapter 8, verse 4 and 5. And yet, very clearly, the book of Hebrews and other passages in the New Testament point out that Christ was foreordained and predicted to serve as a priest. Jesus was born into the world of Old Covenant Israel. He was born according to the flesh, Galatians chapter 4, verse 4. But that means that he was born into a world where he could not serve as priest under that system.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me, under that system and in that world. So what had to happen? He had to be born again into the world of the Spirit. 1 Peter chapter 3, he was put to death in the flesh, made alive in the Spirit. And as you've very well pointed out in the past, those are locatives there, which means he was born into the realm of locative, the flesh, but he was raised in, that is, located in the realm of. Doesn't mean he was born a physical body and then raised a spiritual body. That has nothing to do with the substance of Jesus' biological birth or of his resurrection birth, birth body, if you please, insofar as his personal body. It has to do with the realms into which he was born, located. Okay, so here we have Jesus being born in the flesh, and being born, if you please, in the Spirit, in the realm of the Spirit. So that means that he could then serve, not on earth, not under the law as a priest, but as a matter of fact, he could serve in the heavenly places as a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And so Christ had to be born into that heavenly realm. And the writer of Hebrews is just replete with this kind of language. But it means that he also, since he was going to serve in the heavenly realm, i.e. in the Spirit, it means he was also the high priest over the true tabernacle, which God pitched, and not man. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1 and 2. So this brings us directly into the temple imagery and to the true tabernacle imagery. And I don't know how much more I need to develop that, William, but that gives us the substance of it, that it was in Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, according to Hebrews chapter 2, according to Hebrews 5, Hebrews chapter 7, thou art my son, speaking of the resurrection, this day, speaking of the resurrection of Christ, this day have I begotten you. Well, he was the son of God under Torah, no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
We see that at his baptism. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. We see Jesus declared to be the Son on the Transfiguration. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. But he was born into the realm of the Spirit and declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection out from among the dead, Romans chapter 1 and verse 4. So the New Testament is very clear that Christ was born again. He was born once according to the flesh. He was born again according to the Spirit and served as high priest forever over the everlasting temple.
Okay. All right. Well, that was just an absolute great foundation, great setup. And you covered so many of the texts that, you know, I covered last week on some of the points, which just shows the continuity between this material. And just think, you and I didn't get together and say, okay, this is what we're going to do.
No, we didn't talk at all.
Yeah, that information is just so clearly written in the scriptures. Well, let's go to the book of John and let's talk about it a little bit. Now, in the Gospel of John, and the reason I asked about born again is because this the flow of what goes on in the Gospel of John. But let's just talk about this for a moment. Now, the Gospel of John introduces Christ as the Word, and it says, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." But now, one of the most significant statements which is made in John 1 is found in verse 14. And what does it say, Don?
Became flesh and tabernacled among us.
Now think about it. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Now there is another very interesting text, and you've already pointed out from your earlier comments and referring to James Jordan's commentary as well, where he points out that the Garden of Eden was a tabernacle, and so the tabernacle typology begins there. But there's something else that I want to get into this discussion. In Psalm 90, the text says, "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." Now, here's a text that says that God was their dwelling place from before the world was created. In other words, this God who created the world was Israel's dwelling place. Now, we know...
May I interrupt right here, William?
Yes, right ahead.
There is a very fascinating concept and parallel to this idea that even though God set a physical edifice in the midst of Israel, in Ezekiel chapters 10 and 11, and
yes,
the historical context of Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11 is the imminent fall of Jerusalem, the imminent destruction of the physical edifice of the temple.
Go ahead. You're heading right where I was going, so I'm just going to let you do it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean
to. No, not a problem. Go ahead and lay the foundation you're going to lay.
So here is God getting ready to destroy the physical edifice. But in Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11, God said as he was going to scatter the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem away from the physical edifice, he said, "I will be a dwelling place for you." That's not the exact language, but he uses temple imagery
exactly
to say to them that even though they're scattered among the nations, even though they are scattered away from the physical edifice, even though he was going to destroy the physical edifice, he was saying to them, "I'm going to be your temple for you, even outside of the land." This language is absolutely incredible, and it must have been shocking, William. You know, it must have been just almost traumatic language and perplexing, to say the very, very least, to the good faithful Jews of the time. I mean, after all, back here in Deuteronomy chapter 12, the Lord had said, "The time is coming in which I'm going to set my presence among you. I will choose a place, and that's where you will worship me. You will not worship me anywhere else. That's where sacrifices will be offered, nowhere else." And now all of a sudden, after hundreds of years of that temple standing there, being the very focus of their devotion and their worship and their world, what does God say? Guess what? I'm going to tear it down at the hand of the pagans, and it doesn't matter, because even though you're scattered, I will be your dwelling place among the heathens.
Yes. Very well done. Very well done. And no pun intended. But here, and ladies and gentlemen, in the words of Don Preston, you have to catch the power of this.
Oh, you're stealing.
Until I find me one, I got to use it. But what we're saying here, what the Bible is saying, as Don is establishing, we've looked at the text in Psalm, and the text says, "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. In other words, that is an emphatic statement that God himself is the tabernacle. Even before we get to Revelation, when we look at Hebrews, we understand from Hebrews chapter 9 that the structure that Moses built and was simply a copy of the true tabernacle. Well, what was that true tabernacle? It was God himself. And now think about it. Here's this tabernacle, which is existing based on the text that Don just gave us. When they went into exile, here is God saying, I will be a little sanctuary among them or among you. So he's telling them, I'm going to be your sanctuary. And by the way, he renews the promise to them that they shall be, I will be their God, they shall be my people in that same context. I think it's around verse 20 there. But at any rate, so here is God. I want you to get this picture as we come to John, because here is Christ, as the Bible says, which is almost parallel to the text in Psalm 90. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made, and the Word was made flesh. Well, Don, what is that text saying? It's saying that the tabernacle of God became flesh. The Word was made flesh and tabernacled among us.
Mm-hmm.
So here is God, who existed in the Spirit prior to the incarnation of Christ, that is, Christ, who was in the Spirit prior to his incarnation. He comes into the world, and the Bible says he tabernacled among them. Now, there's something I'm going to skip over in John 1. I don't know if we'll have time to talk about it today, but we'll get to it. Well, let me just throw it in since we're on it. Okay, if you go back, you remember in John 1 where the text talks about when Jesus finds Nathanael, or Nathanael, the discussion with Nathanael, I think it is, and then he says, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man, you shall see the heavens open, and the Son of Man, the angels of God
descending on the Son of Man. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's taken from Genesis chapter 28. And if you go back to Genesis 28 and you look at, you know, the story about Jacob's ladder, and even if you look in verse 11, three times in that text he talks about this place, that place, etc. And he concludes by saying, this is none other than the gate of heaven and the house of God. So, in other words, that was an example as well of God's presence in that place, but it was a tabernacle presence. Well, here is John 1 pulling that same concept right after the statement has been made that Jesus tabernacled among them. And then here is John adding this in John 1:51 that takes him back to this concept where Jacob said, this is none other than the house of God. And it is an opening up of heaven. Now, Stephen also mentions that concept in when he's talking about the tabernacle, and he's saying that God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands in Acts chapter 7. And when they are about to stone him, what does he do? He looks up, sees the heavens open, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Same context. Again, the connection in my mind shouldn't be missed. Now, so when you get to John chapter 2, Jesus goes in and he cleanses the temple. And then the question comes up, by what authority do you do this? And what's his response to them? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will do what?
Raise it up again.
Okay? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now, it's obvious that when many people, particularly the Jews, when Jesus made most of the statements in the Gospel of John, they misunderstood him, did they not?
Most assuredly.
On almost everything he talked about that related to spiritual things, they misunderstood him. My question is, has the church also misunderstood him, particularly in this particular in this text, John 2:19-22, when Jesus said, destroy this temple. Now think about it. He's introduced as the temple that has been their dwelling place from all generations. He's been made flesh. He cleanses the temple, and then he says, when they ask for the authority, he says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now, obviously, and we agree wholeheartedly, that he spoke of the temple of his body, but I want to talk about that. When I say that, what I meant when I said we wholeheartedly agree, we do not deny that Jesus' physical body was raised. What is that, Luke 24:39? When he said, a spirit does not have flesh and bone, as you see I have. And when some still doubt it, he said, well, do you have anything to eat? And they gave him broiled fish and a piece of honeycomb, and he ate. Which I think is a very significant text, too, when you think about what we're saying here. I think it's a very important text that Jesus proved that he was still in a fleshly body after his resurrection. But as you've pointed out on the new birth, and that's why I said it's interesting how this flows, because in the very next section, after he talks about raising up the temple, the next discussion is about the new birth of that which is born in the flesh is flesh, and that which is born in the spirit is spirit. I just find this so fascinating. Now, when Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up, it is the natural inclination for most people to see that he's talking about his physical body. But I would suggest, based on the evidence that you've presented and on additional information that I will present, and based on the conversation that we've had about how he's introduced in the Gospel of John, that what he's saying that he's going to raise up is the new temple, is the temple of his spiritual body. Think about it in this manner. Now, you've already established that he was born again. Another point that we could make in here is Jesus being the seed, and we use some of the same passages that you did. He came in the flesh as the seed of David according to the flesh, but he rose according to the spirit of holiness by the resurrection of the dead. He rose in the realm of the spirit. Remember when at his crucifixion, something happened in the temple with the veil. The text says that the veil was torn from top to bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we know that that happened with the physical temple. But something also happened with another veil, according to Hebrews chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
It says a new and a living way was opened up, by which he is consecrated for us through his through the veil, that is his what? His flesh. So in other words, Jesus' flesh was considered a veil of a temple. It is a veil of a temple, just like John 1:14 established. All right, and he says that opened up a new and living way. Well, what is the new and living way that was opened up in that context? It's the tabernacle. It's the spiritual tabernacle. When Paul says, Psalm 118, every text, Matthew 21, all of those passages that talk about, behold, I lay in Zion a stone, a sure foundation, etc. That stone is the foundation of what? And I'm asking you these questions. They're rhetorical questions, but, I mean, you can respond to them. You may not, I don't know if you agree with what I'm saying, but it would be hard for me to see how Jesus is not speaking about this new temple based on his resurrection in the realm of the spirit compared to the temple dwelling. As we said in the first lesson, here we have Christ making an exodus from the realm of Judaism, from the old covenant system. We have him being the firstborn from the dead. Well, with that and his being the foundation, he would have to be laying the foundation of the temple. Now, it's also interesting. Just let me bring this up. In Mark 14:58, there was a discussion from the false witnesses And this the message from the false witnesses was that we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. Now, you brought up Beal a moment ago, and not only did you discuss Beal and his emphasis on the tabernacle, but one of the things he says in his book on the tabernacle was that every time we see this phrase, not made with hands, it is always a reference to a spiritual tabernacle.
That's exactly right.
Now, some may object and say, well, when Jesus talked about, when the false witnesses made their statement, because let's take the two statements in John just to parallel this for a moment. Now, in John 2, it doesn't mention the concept that I will build it without hands, but it doesn't mean that that wasn't stated. The conflict between the false witnesses' testimony could have been on their belief that he was talking about the structural temple, which he wasn't. There doesn't have to be a conflict between these phrases where it says, I will raise it up in 3 days. I will make one made without hands. Now, if we think about what this refers to, when he says, I build another temple made without hands in 3 days, that meant that at his resurrection, he had to be building the new temple from that point, which again goes back to the foundation laid in Zion. It goes back to Jesus being born in the realm of the Spirit. As you pointed out, today you are my son, I have begotten you. And this text in Mark that says you destroy this temple. See, their concept was they were focusing, in my opinion, on the structural temple. But the point being that Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. Now, that makes sense to me, but I think it's still, even if you don't take that as how it works out, it's very interesting that we have this statement that he would build another temple within 3 days made without hands.
What's fascinating to me, William, to just interrupt here, and I don't want to interrupt too much because I'm really enjoying you develop this, but what's fascinating to me is that these false witnesses. Now, scholars have pondered, what is it about these witnesses that was false? Okay? Did they actually hear Jesus expound at some point saying that he would raise up a temple not made with hands? Well, it's certainly possible that on an occasion that we do not have recorded in the Gospels, they heard him speak of a temple not made with hands. To go back to the imagery of the foundation stone, Jesus during his ministry mentioned the foundation stone, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Jesus appeals to Psalms 118 a couple of different times in his ministry and applies it to him. And so it's certainly possible that these quote, false witnesses were not reporting something that was false. It was that they themselves had never actually heard it, but that they were given the words by the high priest or the leading Jews who had indeed heard it, although the witnesses themselves had not actually heard it themselves, that they were just hired to say this. To me, it's not perfectly clear in what way they're false witnesses. Because as you are pointing out here, I think in a very marvelous way, it's very intriguing, it's very clear that that Jesus did promise to raise up a temple not made with hands. So in what way were they false witnesses?
Right. And I think, you know, one of the ways in which they were false witnesses was the way that you see in John 2, when they said this temple was 40 and 6 years in building and you're going to raise it up in 3 days. Well, if they were taking his words, as we've seen in most of the occasions in John, to be a reference to that structural temple, And, you know, that is one way in which they were misunderstanding and misapplying what he was saying.
Yes.
So I think that that is where the their witnesses don't agree because of what's stated there. But this concept of building this temple in 3 days, and if you think about it, if he died in the realm of the flesh and was the tabernacle that came, as you said earlier, as the Bible says, he was made of a woman, he was made under the law. So my question would be, when Jesus rose from the dead, did he rise back into the realm of the flesh? Did he rise
back? No, he
back
did not.
Under the law. Romans chapter 7 says the law only has dominion over a person as long as he lived. When Jesus rose, he said he was no longer, Paul says he was no longer under the law. That means
that's exactly
he was
right.
In a new realm, in a new world at that point. And what and that's why I said the statements that about Jesus taking the time on earth to continue to be in his physical body while he was in the new spiritual tabernacle is absolutely just fascinating.
Yes, it is. It
and
truly
it shows
is.
Us, it shows us why we can be in the resurrection and still in our physical body, because that's exactly what Jesus did.
Excellent point.
Awesome.
Excellent
that,
point.
That's awesome, me. That is awesome. All right, so
William, did you let me ask you a question here? Last week,
sure,
did you
sure.
develop? pardon me. This may be a little bit off, but it's still directly related to the entire topic here of the connection between tabernacle and temple imagery and resurrection. Mm-hmm. But did you incorporate Jeremiah chapter 3?
I didn't mention Jeremiah 3, but it definitely figures in. Go ahead and introduce it. We've got like 2 minutes, 45 seconds, so go ahead and put it in.
Okay, Jeremiah chapter 3 is such a fascinating text. Jeremiah chapter 3 is dealing once again with the context of Judah's dispersion. Remember, Assyria has already carried off the 10 northern tribes over 200 years prior. The 10 northern tribes are without a temple, a priesthood, a sacrifice, and a seraphim, according to Hosea chapter 3. Now, Judah is getting ready to be carried off into Babylonian captivity. The Babylonians have since destroyed the Assyrians, therefore the 10 northern tribes are now in Babylonian captivity already. But here we have a great, great promise by the Lord. And the Lord said that the time was coming in which Israel would once again be increased. But God said that the time was coming in which they would no more go to Jerusalem, nor would they say the Ark of the Covenant, nor would they visit it anymore, because it would not be remembered anymore. Now, this is an absolutely astounding text, but it agrees perfectly with what Jesus is saying in John chapter 4. Remember, John 4, Jesus is dealing with a woman from Samaria. Samaria is kind of the epitaph, if you please, the symbolic word for the 10 northern tribes scattered abroad who with a corrupted temple, a corrupted worship. There had been a temple on Mount Gerizim in which the Samaritans worshipped, but it had been destroyed almost 200 years before Jesus came. Okay, so that temple of the Samaritans was now destroyed. But there was still this ongoing conflict between Jerusalem and the Samaritans. And I don't have time to develop historically some of the conflict and some of the things that went on there, but they're fascinating. They're humorous now that we can look at them in retrospect. But there were some bloody, bloody conflicts between Samaritans and Judeans. But the Samaritans, very simply stated, said, Gerizim is the only proper place to worship Yahweh. Well, obviously, the Jerusalem inhabitants still had the temple there, and they said, no, no, no. Gerizim was never the proper place to worship. It is Jerusalem. So here is the battle of the two cities, the battle of the two temples. But incredibly, Jeremiah said the time was coming in which men would no longer even go to Jerusalem. They would not remember the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the word remember there is a word that is used to speak of covenantal remembrance. Mm-hmm. In other words, the time was coming in which the Ark of the Covenant would lose all covenantal significance, which means, of course, that Jerusalem itself, as a geocentric location, would likewise lose its centricity. Well, what's that? What's Jesus saying? Now, I say all that to bring this point up. Jeremiah 3:16 and 17 says, it would be the time in which all 12 tribes would once again be reunited. Well, let's see. Ezekiel chapter 37 says that all 12 tribes would be reunited when the new covenant was established under the Messiah, the lineage of David, and when God raised Israel from the dead out of her graves by sending forth the Spirit, Ezekiel 37, 10 to 12. So, the reunification, if you please, the restoration of Israel is resurrection, Ezekiel chapter 37. The time when all 12 tribes would serve God under the new covenant. By the way, William, perhaps we should note very, very quickly, if the resurrection of Israel hasn't occurred, the new covenant has not been established, because the resurrected Israel would serve God under the new covenant, according to Ezekiel. So what do we find? We find in Jeremiah chapter 3 the promise of the restoration of all 12 tribes, which is resurrection according to Ezekiel 37. But Ezekiel 37, the resurrection of Israel would be at the time in which God set his tabernacle among them. He would be their God, they would be his people. So we have in Jeremiah chapter 3, Ezekiel 37, and John chapter 4, Jesus saying the time in which Jerusalem as well as Gerizim would lose all geocentricity. But the time of the resurrection of Israel, the restoration of Israel, which would be the time of the new tabernacle, according to Ezekiel 37, Jesus said the hour is coming, and now is. These imageries of tabernacle and resurrection cannot be divorced from one another.
Absolutely. And so let's wrap up on that point. When we see Jesus in Matthew 21 talking about the parable of the vineyard, and stating when God sends the Son, or when the landowner sends the Son, and here are the Jews who say, come, let us kill him and let us seize his inheritance. It's showing that the time the foundation stone is laid is at the time of Jesus' death. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Well, what was it a cornerstone to? It's a cornerstone to the temple. That's exactly what Paul says in Ephesians 2, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. They are being built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, and that was growing into an holy temple in the Lord. So in other words, what you have there is the temple connected to the resurrection of Christ. That's exactly what Jesus said. Destroyed this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. We didn't get to so far passages in 1 Peter chapter 2 that need to be discussed, Ephesians. But here's the point. Now we have very clearly demonstrated that the temple that was raised up at Jesus' death was his spiritual temple, the temple of his body. That's his spiritual body that, of course, he's the first of the first fruits. He's first there, and then, of course, we have those on Pentecost who enter in. But here is Jesus experiencing that in his fleshly body, which shows that the resurrection And the new tabernacle, the house not made with hands, was not his physical body. It was not about his physical body from that perspective. It was the house not made with hands, the dwelling place of God. And that theme is carried all the way through. It establishes it as spiritual. It's in the realm of the spirit. And it shows the connection of resurrection with the temple in John 4, as well as John 5. There is no difference all the way from the time of Christ, from his resurrection, all the way up to Revelation 21, the house not made with hands. That's where death is removed. And I think it's just an absolutely fascinating study and concept, and it's one that we really need to give some attention to so we truly understand Jesus' words, destroy this temple, in 3 days I will raise it up. He raised up a new temple, not according to flesh, the temple where they would dwell with God in spirit and in truth. And that's what he invites all men to come through the tearing of his veil, or his body, which was the veil, so that we could enter into that new and living way. Any closing thoughts, Don?
No, I don't think so, William. It's a fascinating program, fascinating thoughts.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for bearing with us tonight. Thank you for being in the chat room. And those of you who listen by archive, we appreciate it. That will be available in about 15 minutes. At some point in time, I am going to download this one to take out all the extraneous comments on the front about us not being able to get in. But Don and I finally got it figured out, and it worked pretty well once we did. So we're just going to keep plugging through, and we thank you for being with us. Have a good night, and God bless.